Hello and welcome to a unique episode of our podcast Welthungerhilfe Direkt. My name is Lena and I've been a regular host here. But today we are doing something different. This podcast is in English for the first time. The idea for this episode came from our colleague Caroline. She was working in South Sudan as a junior expert until some time ago. Now she's working in Congo, by the way. In South Sudan, Caroline spent a lot of time with local colleagues and heard very special stories from their turbulent lives. We are listening to them today. Why today? Because it is Independence Day in South Sudan. The Declaration of Independence took place on July 9th in 2011. Thank you, Caroline, for the wonderful idea and the realization of the recording. And thanks to the South Sudanese colleagues for sharing their life stories.
As an employee of Welthungerhilfe, I have lived and worked in a place called Benchu in the north of South Sudan for the past 8 months in a camp for IDPs, which are internally displaced persons. There is an index called the UN Human Development Index, and that is used to measure progress of a country. And according to this index, South Sudan ranks last of all 191 countries assessed. The humanitarian crisis in South Sudan is devastating. According to estimates, more than two-thirds of the entire population are food insecure. And when the country became independent from Sudan in 2011, conflict, which was steered by political elites, broke out and led to horrendous violence and mass displacement. On top of all of this, there have been floods last year, which were the worst in the past 60 years. And of course, these floods have led to further displacement as well as a worsening of the already dire food security situation. It is expected that this year, in 2023, almost 80% of the country's population is in need of some kind of humanitarian assistance. Of course, we could be talking about all of these aspects in detail today, but this podcast episode is neither about the humanitarian situation in South Sudan, nor my own experiences in Benchu or the activities that Welthungerhilfe is implementing. Instead, it's an episode about my South Sudanese colleagues from Benchu who are living and working among the communities we serve and who themselves oftentimes have experienced traumatic encounters of displacement, family separation and violence. And despite all of this, have shown high and incredible resilience and commitment to the work we're doing and the people we offer support to. When I first arrived in Benchu, everybody welcomed me with open arms to Benchu Paradise, as it is called. And we shared a small 12 square meter container among seven of us. So that really allowed us to quickly get to know each other. And we were chatting and laughing over tea and oftentimes enjoying some kind of mix of, let's say, German and South Sudanese breakfast, which is a deep fried yeast dough called mandazi with Nutella. And so we had many conversations, and at one point, with the consent of my colleagues, I started recording some of these personal exchanges on my phone. We talked about life in camp, we talked about the situation of women in Benchu, and we talked about the Nuer culture more in general. And all of this is to be able to share my colleagues' realities. And this episode is about them as Nuer people, about them as Benchu IDP camp residents, and of course also about them as Welthungerhilfe colleagues.
So my name is Mike Fort. Mike means fire. The reason why they call it fire, I was born when there was a fire burning in a bush. Then my mother given birth to me. That's why I was called Mike.
I'm Nyacha. Nyacha in Nuer, it means creation.
Well, mean my mother and grandmother is quarreling during delivery.
When you had somebody being called Gatnyai, it means flooding. It was born during the flooding.
Good morning. My name is Margaret. Traditional name I'm calling Chanyal. Chanyal means that a girl.
My name is Dor. So the meaning of Dor, when I was born in the bush. That's why they call me Dor.
My name is Daniel Oscar. Daniel is a Christian name, and Waska, that is a family name. And I would like to also explain the meaning of Waska. My father was cultivating in the gardens, and my mother was trying to take water to her husband, which is my father. And that process, he gave birth in the garden.
I'm Nyasebit. Nyasebit means I was born on Saturday.
And my name is Caroline, which, to much regret of my colleagues, doesn't really have a deeper meaning connected to my birth, but according to Google, either means little womanly one or the free one. After nearly two decades of a long and violent civil war, South Sudan became independent from Sudan in 2011. During the time, many people, including our field officer John Mashpot, had fled to neighboring countries for safety, particularly to the countries of Kenya, Uganda, and into what's today Sudan. So once South Sudan became independent on the 9th of July 2011, the excitement about the country's freedom was felt everywhere, and many of the previously displaced people had returned home to their place of origin.
Yeah, since South Sudan became independent, I was very happy because I feel that I have the country. I feel that my movement will become free and my life will be much more easier. So I feel very excited, and I think whatever I'm doing for my future will not rely on a village life.
Unfortunately, this initial excitement didn't last long. So just 2 years after the youngest country in the world became independent, a political crisis followed, and that led to conflict in December 2013 and resulted in more than 1.3 million internal displacements in the year 2014.
Since we get independent it was 2011, we just enjoy our resources for almost only 2 years, which is 2011 and 2012. At the end of 2013, the crisis was started, and then we start running to the bush because it was declared that instead of emergency, no security. Your security is by your own hand. Either you run away or you stay. Once you stay, those people, if they came, they can kill you.
This is Margaret. And she was just 23 years old when violence first erupted in the capital, Juba, where her children were. So she tried to get them out and get them to be with her in Benshu. But she told me that just a couple of days after her kids were in Benshu with her, violence also reached the north of South Sudan. So she took her kids and they fled together into the bush. She told me that because she grew up in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, she only knew life in the city with all its comforts, so she wasn't used to having to find food and prepare it out in the bush in order to be able to survive. She said she stayed there for almost 4 months, and they were eating what they could find, and she was trying to keep her family safe before she heard about the UN peacekeepers base called what is today IDP. Back then it was called POC, Protection of Civilian Side. So she fled there together with her children.
I stayed there for almost 3 to 4 months. And then I heard that there was a UN base camp, which is POC, where am I today.
And what does POC stand for?
POC is a protection of civilians.
Mm-hmm.
It's called POC. And now after the peace agreement, the revitalization peace agreement, is turned to IDP.
Within a very short period of time, thousands of people fled to the UN peacekeeping site to seek safety. Today, still more than 110,000 people live there. So Zazal, who is one of our drivers, described life to camp at the time of crisis to me.
Life was much hard for me in POC, and things are getting, they don't even allow people to go outside. Too much gunshot around, so it was like prison to us. You know, we don't move outside, and we only survive from the humanitarian assistance that at least.
The level of violence was horrendous, and many people lost loved ones. When remembering the crisis in 2013, my colleague John Mashpot always thinks about the loss of his 4 siblings.
Then in this crisis, when it happened, it brought a lot of things. Like in my mother, we were four. Then because of this crisis, then three of my brothers were killed.
Wow, questions.
Then plus one of our sisters, which is our last born and our mother's, he died when she was giving birth.
Oh.
Then also taking care of those families because they are still vulnerable. I also took some of the children to school also with my kid.
The initial excitement that was felt across the country in 2011 at the time of independence became one of desperation and huge humanitarian need. Now, 10 years after independence, the country is not only grappling with severe food insecurity, large numbers of displacement, tribal conflicts, violence, but also climate shocks such as floodings, which last year almost affected 1 million people.
There was no dry place, only POC and the town, which is dry. Many women's livestock, they're making agriculture. They're selling some and they're putting some for their family. But due to this flood, it is really difficult for them.
Mm.
Yeah. Even the floods affect, there was no firewood. Bush is having a lot of water. It is also displaced many people from their homes. Like we used to have village in Nialdiu, Greater Gwid, Greater O'Connor. Now this place was demanded with a lot of water. And also this water give a lot chance of a snake bite. Especially for the women, because they used to carry firewood within the water using plastic sheet.
Yeah, there's the gangs. Now also the gangs are even worse than people who are shooting people outside. Gangs are even making some more problems, kidnapping people at night, taking the little thing you have with your family, seeing any good clothes from you, good shoes, anything. If they see you like you have a little job that you are doing, come and attack you at night and take everything you have. So also gangs are getting worse and worse than people who are shooting now.
After everything I heard from my colleagues about the past and the current situation in Benshu, I asked my colleague John why he returned to South Sudan after he lived in Kenya and while his family and children are still in Uganda.
I flee to Kenya. Then this is where I held my education.
So you went to school in Kenya?
I went to school in Kenya.
And why did you decide to come back to Benshu?
I feel Benshu is home, and I feel like to come back home. Then when I came here, then I came before this conflict. Then I got married, and I feel like to stay home. Then when things become very worse, I went with my families. I went to Uganda. When life became very hard, I came back looking for a job. I'm currently working for Feltunga Alpha. So the situation has not changed for everybody, but it has changed economically, slowly, because somebody is earning some little money. It's not like somebody who is earning zeros. So the situation is very worse.
During one of our conversations in the car, one of the drivers in Juba told me that he wished the country almost never became independent. And John Mashput added that it almost feels like South Sudan isn't independent at all.
Of course, it has changed. But again, some circumstances that happen, like this current, like the tribal conflict, which has teared the country into pieces. Again, it is worsened by the flooding, by the current flooding, which everybody is being affected. Most of South Sudanese fled to other countries. And the only few people who are staying here are still vulnerable. It looks like the happiness that people were hoping about South Sudan has to bring change because of the independence. So it is currently It is like we never got our independence.
The idea for this special episode was actually born during the rainy season when thunderstorms, unlike I've ever experienced, hit us almost every day and sometimes left the entire place flooded. There were even times when thunder made the entire ground shake. Unfortunately, of course, the temporary shelters, which you must imagine are made of plastic sheets and sticks or aluminium, have very little to counter against the rain and the wind. So when I was laying in my container at night, I always thought about my colleagues and everybody else outside in Benshu. And then the next morning, when there were 7 pairs of gumboots outside and we were all barefoot inside our office, we always exchanged about how the night had been. And it was really incredible for me to see how my colleagues showed up every day at work and gave their utmost best while sometimes actually having had nights of no to little sleep. What is maybe so special and unique about Welthungerhilfe's operation in South Sudan is that here we are an implementing organization ourselves, which means that unlike in almost all other Welthungerhilfe program countries, where we work mainly through local partner NGOs, we are in direct and daily exchange with the communities we work for. In fact, in a country that has been affected by war and violence and climate shocks and a lack of basic services, a considerable proportion of our staff are themselves from and live with the people we offer support to. And I asked John how he felt about living among the people we support.
That I feel okay because this is the country where I was born and the communities where I'm serving are also the people whom I can understand the situation which is affecting them. Then I feel like also I'm also affecting because these are the very people whom I'm serving. And these are the beneficiaries. Then, like me, I'm staying in a camp. I also were beneficiaries. I have a ratio card. Before getting the job, I've been enrolled to get some entitlement in food ratio.
At the same time, this is putting a lot of pressure on the shoulders of my colleagues. We often discussed how they coped with being the sole provider of sometimes up to 25 people, such as Dor, one of our drivers. Currently, Margaret told me that she's financing 3 families from her monthly salary and she's living alone in Benshu in order to be able to support the life of her 3 children and husband in Khartoum in Sudan because he can't work due to a kidney failure. So if she's able to save up enough money and enough leave days during the year, she manages to see her family and children once a year for Christmas.
You are here by yourself and your family is in Khartoum and you're sending all the money to Khartoum. Mm-hmm. So you are the sole provider for your family.
Yeah, I'm the one who taking responsibility, especially like you came to the house and you find people, this is my relative and they're depending on me. If you see it all, 3 family who's depending on me, my family, my parent, plus the relative who is staying with me in the POC.
What does this feel like to you?
Caroline, I tell you, sometimes when this family asking money and my relative ask money and even my kid, they demand money, I feel like sometimes it's stressed up, I tell you. You couldn't imagine. But what to do? Just I'm pushing the life.
Supporting each other and particularly family members with any resources that are available is deeply ingrained in South Sudanese culture. John Mashpot told me that he's currently financing 10 of his family's children as life in Uganda, where they go to school.
We have that ethic that, okay, when somebody has no resources, you also assist that person. You contributed. They only contribute in terms of cattle. When you don't have cattle, maybe your brother can contribute for you. One from this, then you settle. So when I married, I became independent. But I married when 2 of my brothers died. Then I was with the 2. Then those 2 sent me to the school. And so when they leave the world, I also take care of their children. Like me, out of the 4, plus our last born, my sister. Then he had 7 kids. Then I sat with the husband. I took 4 kids. Then he remained with the three.
Wow.
So then in each of my brother's families, I took one child. They are in Uganda with my children.
Zalzal, our driver, who is sharing his salary with four families, told me that although this isn't efficient, they are collectively trying to make it work.
I remember my neighbor and two friends of mine with their family. And
how many people are in the family?
This neighbor, my neighbor, with his wife and the six children. And my friend, one friend of mine is having two wives and the kids, I don't know how many kids. And also another one friend of mine with three wives and the kids, I don't know how many kids, I have not count them. So the little thing that I get from my work, from WHH, that they paid me for, it's not enough for us. It's like four family. My neighbor and my two friends with their family, plus me, hi. So they're not enough, but at least we can do what we can manage. It is better than nothing. So we share, I divide to all of them, and I remain with what I remain with. And I just normally give them advice. Please, let's try to do something. Like, we can make a small business that will add something on top of our money. We have nothing now more than this. So, and we also pray for God at least to keep our job there.
As an international employee, I'm enjoying a good salary, additional rest and recuperation days every 8 weeks, a small additional stipend to be able to support my travels back home during my annual leave. So while I got to leave Benchu every 2 months and be with my family partner and friends, my colleagues only got to visit their children and wives or husbands in a foreign country once a year. And I was sometimes wondering what the difference was between me and them in terms of an international versus a national staff. Because just like me, their families are far away in different countries and they actually saw them less often during the year than I got to go back to Germany. Being the only full-time employed woman on the Weltunger Hilfe team in Benchu, Teresa, our women's empowerment officer, Margaret and I quickly connected. We had this unspoken bond of women's solidarity and shared experiences. But of course, while I, as a white and privileged woman, was able to navigate South Sudan's restrictive gender roles very differently, Margaret and Teresa were still very much limited by them. And although my two female colleagues broke the barriers of accessing good education and being allowed to work, the entire responsibility around any caretaking or household chores still fell exclusively onto them.
Men cannot cook in our culture. Men cannot organize the rooms, no. Only women. Men cannot fetch water. Mm. Men cannot wash his clothes. Cows is important. It is a big major within the Nuer culture because they used to pay dowry with the cows.
Mm.
That dowry, it doesn't have any specific measurement. It is according to father of the girl's interest. If he is dressing in a lot of cow, it is his right. And in the dowry, only man is having decision. Only man is having access to control everything. In our culture, a woman doesn't have say. For example, today my daughter is going to get married. I don't have say to ask, where's those people going to come and we make the celebration? No, it is not my business. I just wait for the man and then he'll tell me, okay, tomorrow we have occasion. Your daughter is being given to so-and-so. And so-and-so is going to pay me this.
When we did a gender analysis in Benchu so we could learn more about the roles and responsibilities of women, men, boys and girls in the society so that we would ensure that our activities are actually not perpetuating harmful gender norms, we also learned that men even have the right to decide the size of the family. Yeah. While we were waiting for the rest of the team to return from one of their visits to the community, Teresa, Margaret and I once had a chat over tea about the life of women in camp. Margaret told me that there are actually three types of women in camp. There is the group of those who are dependent on the collection of firewood and selling it. Then there is a group of women who are running small businesses, such as selling tea or doing some tailoring work. And then there is a third and a small group of women, those like Teresa and Margaret, who oftentimes grew up outside of Benshu, enjoyed good education abroad in Kenya, Uganda, and are now working for NGOs or the UN and are thus able to support their families abroad.
It is really different. Like for me now, I'm working with the NGOs. My children, they are in good place. They are not here with me. Mm. It's only me here living in POC because I'm working here. For my kids, they are getting a good education. They're getting a good treatment. There's no insecurity for them because they're in several places. But for the women who are doesn't have any ability to make something big for their family, they just only depend on a small business. That money cannot feed for them to send their children to Uganda or Kenya or the Sudan. Mm. For them, they're just living here with their kids, no good education, no good treatment for them in case they are getting sickness or what. And those people, their levels is a bit better than people who are depending on firewood. Women who are depending on firewood, they go for a far place, and even while they're moving to looking for firewood, they're at risk. Mm.
At risk of what?
Rape cases are also happening because in the forest. Something bad can harm them.
Snake also, maybe.
A snake, they're moving in water, like flooding now is affecting them seriously. And distant from here, to get firewood, it will take them 2 to 3 days. Oh, footing in the water and coming carry firewood with the plastic sheet. Because there's no dry place. Only POC and Rukona and Banti, which is the place that who are really dry. The rest of the place is a lot conjunction with the water.
According to the UN, 65% of all women and girls in South Sudan will experience some form of sexual and gender-based violence in their lifetime, particularly rape, early enforced marriage, or violence perpetuated by their husbands or other intimate partners. Particularly when women walk far into the bush to collect firewood for the preparation of food, they are at high risk of sexual violence, as the perpetrators largely enjoy impunity or are then told by traditional courts to pay compensation in cows or to marry the sexual violence survivor. Most cases remain unreported, and we can assume that the actual number are to be much higher.
Yes, I can say that. Some women saying that life is difficult. Why they're saying that? Because they're still moving around. They just survive or depending on the firewood. And if you work distant from POC, you get some criminal in the forest. And those people, they used to make violence, rape cases and all these things. That is why they have right to say that they are not safer. Me, I'm saying safe because I'm not using to go for the bush or looking for firewood. A little bit make me safe because I cannot go to different places. I just stay within the POC and I'm safer. But for the person who going to look for the firewood as a woman or a mother for the kid, she's depending on firewood, doesn't have any job or doesn't have any support, it is really hard for her. Yeah, she have right to say that it is not safe.
In South Sudan, harmful gender norms and roles are not only affecting women, but traditionally, Nuer boys' upper and front teeth are pulled and they receive 6 straight horizontal cuts above their forehead when they're young, which turns into scars so that they are marked. My colleague Kawach, our logistics assistant, is one of the men on our team who is not marked. He told me about his experience as one of the only men who isn't marked in his village.
I refuse it because I saw there are towns, there are boys in a town going to school. Then I refuse myself. You know, my elder brother, even my last born brother, was marked. And the reason they advice at home, and then I refused.
And so how did you refuse? How was the reaction by your family?
Yeah, they say that maybe I'm going to be criminals if I'm going to the town. And then I ran from there I came to the town. There was my uncle came to the town early, and then I come and stay with him. If they come to take me back home to be market, my uncle refused this one. This boy cannot be taken to the...
Is village. Your uncle marked?
My uncle in a town? Mm-hmm. Yeah, he marked. He was marked. But he refused, his children cannot be marked again. Then he had me to his children, not to be marked.
How old were you when you ran away from home and you lived with your uncle?
I was having 9 years.
According to traditional belief, men who are not marked are still considered to be children with less rights and power than those men who are marked.
Yes, when I go to the village now, they can call me I'm a boy because I'm not marked.
Wow.
Even if I'm contributing a lot for the words, for other things, they will still tell me that, no, you are a boy.
Men and youth boys are also highly exposed to revenge killings that are only targeting men. When a male family member is killed, this family is taking revenge for the one killed by killing a member of the murderer's family. They in turn then take revenge for the person they lost. So with the risk of such arbitrary killings being so high due to this constant cycle of revenge, some of my male colleagues told me that they are at constant risk and do not really travel far. During my time in Benshu, a male colleague of the World Health Organization was sadly killed in a revenge killing.
These revenge killings happen when one of your relatives has been killed by the other sides of the families. Then the families whom their relative has been killed, or brothers, they tend to retaliate or take a revenge and kill another person, then from the other side. Then the situation became chaos because it goes from one family to another family.
Thankfully, apart from the constant stress and the risk of violence that my colleagues are exposed to on a daily basis, we also laughed a lot and we also exchanged and we had lighter conversations. One of which is a traditional belief that Nuer people hold about snakes and crocodiles. So one afternoon when I was only wearing sandals when I came to the office and I had crossed paths with a black snake, Margaret and Charissa told me that they actually know the family who's related to the black snake. So in case I had been bitten, they could have saved me.
Culturally, here in South Sudan, we believe that there are some people who cannot be bitten by a snake because there's a belief that maybe someone was born with a snake, or they believe it as their goddess. So, previously.
What do you mean they're born?
Like, it's happened sometimes, a woman can give birth to a snake. Mm. A human being giving birth to a snake. Then... from there, maybe it's happened to generation that has already passed, and then it happened like so. Now this story will, the generation will keep telling their grandchildren that your grandmothers give birth to a snake. Now the snake is related to you, is your brother. When you see a snake, don't kill a snake. And also, if the snake bite you, the snake will die. If you kill a snake, you will die.
Do you know who's related to a crocodile and the snake in your community?
Yes, I know. Even some of my cousins, they are related to a snake because, like, we are from the same community, but the crocodile is actually from their family, not from our family. So they are related to crocodile, but we are not related.
Okay, so they can save you?
No, they cannot. Yeah, they can save you. They can come and call the snake if you are not eaten yet.
Yeah.
But if you are already eaten, they are sorry.
It's too late. So there's a small window of time to call for them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
You don't give them like 3 hours. You don't give crocodile like 3 hours because the crocodile may be hungry and hit the person. So after the first one has been taken, maybe after 10 minutes, 20 minutes, you go to the riverside and call the crocodile back.
To my reassurance, Margaret promised me that she knows the family of the black snake really well, so they could have saved me, which was really comforting to know.
For the black one, there's a family who relate to that black snake. They can immediately make for you a first aid. They can use
saliva
to put in that wound of the biting of a snake.
The wound, yeah.
Yes, they can put their saliva.
Yeah.
And also they have some trees in the forest. They know how to bring it, and then they will make other medicine for you.
My time in Benshu is over for now. The past 8 months have been challenging, both physically and mentally, and I'm deeply impressed by my colleagues' resilience, who have lived and worked in this context for sometimes decades, and to those who are coming back to rebuild the society. Our colleagues are leaving behind their families to make a living and to allow their children to grow up in a safer environment and enjoy safety and good schooling outside of South Sudan. They are the ones who are doing the daily activities of Welthungerhilfe while oftentimes being themselves from the communities we work for and are impacted by the humanitarian crisis that's affecting the country. I am deeply thankful for everyone I met in Benchu and who welcomed me into their lives, homes and families, who trusted me with their stories, those that we recorded, but also just the normal ones we had on a daily basis, and who told me so much about the Nuer culture and allowed me to ask questions and learn. Shukran.
Das war Welthungerhilfe direkt, der Podcast der Welthungerhilfe. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, empfehlt den Podcast gerne weiter. Und natürlich freuen wir uns über Feedback, Lob und Kritik an podcast@welthungerhilfe.de. Bis zum nächsten Mal bei Welthungerhilfe direkt.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.